This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show in the members segment with a very special guest, Donald Schmidt. Donald, welcome back to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Thanks for having me, James.
Well, we talked in the intermission about one of the methods with which they've managed to squelch so much of this information, that being the laughter and the ridicule curtain. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it's important, because there's still that carryover effect. To this day, we see that in the mainstream media
Yeah.
and in mainstream pundits and podcasters as well. So, your thoughts on that?
Well, when we always maintain, we always state that Roswell remains the granddaddy of all UFO cases because it encompasses just all the elements that then, has become the entire UFO enigma as we know it. And unlike things that are very fleeting, something in the sky, maybe something lands on the ground, now you see it, now you don't. With Roswell, with a crash, with a recovery, a retrieval operation, you have all the evidence to demonstrate that you're dealing with something off the planet, so to speak. It then becomes a case of where is it today? Why isn't Congress demanding to see the physical evidence? We're talking about whistleblowers who only talk about what they've heard, as opposed to, well, I can take you exactly to where the wreckage is being reverse engineered, where they're testing it. I can take you where the bodies are being cryogenically stored after all this time, that type of thing. So that's why we're dealing in many respects with the unwashed in Washington. They know next to nothing about this subject. And that's why we've offered our services. We've been in contact with Congressman Tim Burchett's office, as well as Congressman Glenn Grothman's office, who's also on the committee. We'll tell you who to subpoena. We'll tell you who you should, as far as bring in to testify. Don't listen to these, as far as witnesses, so to speak, who can only suggest who might have information. No, we can tell you who has information. And I can tell you, for example, who started the whole ridicule factor, who made sure that this would become a taboo topic, a career breaker. The idea that if you so much as describe something strange, driving home late some night after maybe playing bingo or a sheep's head or something, as far as something very innocent, and you saw something that defied conventional explanation. Where did it begin that these people should be ostracized, that they should be smeared, discredited at every extent? Well, there again, it began with Roswell. The very arbiter, one of the arbiters of the balloon explanation, the cover-up, General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force stationed at Carswell Army Airfield in Fort Worth, Texas. And he was on an El Paso, Texas radio show within days after that balloon explanation. And the host of the show said to him, "General, that explains Roswell. Roswell was merely a balloon. The person of Roswell overreacted. They got all excited and they mistakenly misidentified a balloon as something made from another planet." Now, that in itself sounds pretty ridiculous, doesn't it? But the host would then add, "But isn't it true, General, that there have been flying saucer sightings in every state throughout the country?" To which General Ramey answered in the affirmative, "Yes, that is true. There have been flying saucer sightings in every state throughout America, except for Kansas, which is a dry state." So, in other words, for the first time, they inferred that only people that over imbibe, only people who drink, see such things. Kansas, where it's illegal to sell, purchase alcohol, that's why there aren't any sightings there. That's where it began.
Yes,
And it
that
only
dismissive.
snowballed after that. So it was all staged. It was all planned in such a way that, okay, we took a high gamble. We took a high risk in switching the weather balloon for the actual material. But the press bought it. The country breathed a sigh of relief. We're not being invaded. It's not Russian technology. It's nothing we have to be afraid of. It was just one of ours, just a little weather balloon, nothing else to be, concerned with. But then they drove the point home. They had balloon demonstrations all over the country, in the newspapers, all documented. They wanted to make sure that, well, it worked with Roswell. Maybe we can get them to back off of all the other reports that they're all going to question that, well, maybe it's a balloon. And to this day, James, the Air Force, the Pentagon, still maintains, they still suggest, well, we've explained a lot of sightings away as just simply weather balloons. That's true. But that's at 10,000 feet where the balloon can become compressed, become elliptoid, it can reflect the sunlight, it's devoid of wings and tail section. It can move erratically. It can bob and weave. It can do things that a conventional aircraft would never do. So it looks strange. Again, at 10,000 feet, Roswell is the one and only time that a weather balloon was misidentified as a flying saucer. On the ground, right in front of you, where you can pick it up and hold it in your hands and see it's nothing but conventional rubber, foil, sticks, string, and tape.
And that's another thing that flies in the face of the eyewitness testimony was the unusual, extraordinary properties of the material itself. There were people at Roswell and then people at Wright Field that were describing the same thing. And could you, just to put the skeptics in their place once and for all about the material, tell us about the foil. Tell us about some of the other materials that were found at the site.
Now, mind you, we have over 30 firsthand witnesses to the actual material. Once again, I emphasize there is not a single witness who described a weather balloon or any materials thereof. None whatsoever. And even beyond a weather balloon, none that described plane wreckage, rocket wreckage, nothing prosaic. Nothing conventional. All of the firsthand Roswell witnesses, both military and civilian, have described the following: paper-thin, metal-like material. They weren't even sure if it was metal or not. Weightless in your hands. You didn't know if you were even holding it. You couldn't cut it. You couldn't burn it. Even a bullet wouldn't penetrate it. Engineers the Roswell base described to us how they took a 16-pound sledgehammer. Next time any of your viewers are at a hardware store, pick up a 16-pound hammer. It'll go through your car like tissue paper. Yet the engineers described that no matter how often or how hard they would strike this wreckage, they couldn't even scratch it with a 16-pound hammer. I-beam sections of the same material with strange hieroglyphic-like symbols that ran the length of each piece. Never deciphered, never decoded. Silken strands of material like microfilament fishing line. You could hold a light up to one end, and the light would emit. It would come out the opposing, the opposite end. Well, what are they describing? Fiber optics. If fiber optics wouldn't be developed for another 23 years around 1970. And then the most amazing material of all, we still are looking for it. I've led now six archaeological digs to the crash site where we're still looking for our holy grail, so to speak. So this is the same nearly indestructible metal-like material. But this you could fold, you could crease, you could crumble into a ball. And each and every time you would place it down, it would unfurl, it would unravel, it would flow like water as it would smooth out and it would assume its original shape and size. In other words, it possessed perfect memory. Perfect memory. And this is back in 1947. Now we're first getting there. So maybe we'd had some breakthroughs, but the point being, this was right before your eyes. And we have, again, dozens of witnesses who describe pulling a piece out from a shirt pocket or displaying it to a friend or a colleague at the base, or even the men who were part of the recovery operation, who'd be grabbing pieces off the ground, and like Sergeant Edward Fulford, who was putting pieces into a knapsack, a gunny sack over his back, and he could feel them unravel. He could feel them open up and starting to jab and poke him in the back, piece after piece. So it creates a wonderful imagery of what these men went through. There was a young daughter of one of the ranchers, and it was Mac Brazo, W.W. Brazo's son, Bill, who took a piece of the memory material to show her. Went over to their ranch, drove over in his pickup truck, and she's describing to us, she's watching as he's doing this, as he's grasping, he's gripping his hand, compressing this piece of metal, and every time he would open his hand, it would flow, it would smooth right out, even between his fingers. And she described to us that her immediate reaction was, "My God, wouldn't it be wonderful if clothes would be made of the same material? I would never have to iron again." So again, it gives you the imagery of what she was witnessing at the time. So it paints the same picture every time, no matter who the witness. And I love that based on their background, their own perspective, it still shows that this was memory material. You can't envision it any other way. That's what they're describing.
Yes, and the variety of the eyewitnesses too, because take us to the right path, and there's the T1 division, there's a T2 division. Tell us
Correct.
the significance of each one of those and their role in doing analysis on the wreckage.
Well, you actually, it was T2 and T3.
T2 and T3, okay.
T2 was engineering, whereas T3 was intelligence. And the fact that when the wreckage, when the materials came in, and when specifically, we call it Foreign Technology Division, FTD. And we always have heard the legend, the rumor of Hangar 18, that the materials and the bodies were stored at Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Well, in reality, there is no Hangar 18. There's a Hangar 23, which adjoins Building 18, A, B, C, and D, and so on. It's a red brick complex, but the hangar had a tunnel that went beneath into Building 18, and that's where the wreckage and the bodies originally arrived. Okay, and so that was T2 back in 47. And the fact that why would again this wreckage go to engineering
Yes.
for testing and analysis? Again, it makes no sense, but yet it did. Yet it did. And then through all these years, all the rumor, all the talk, and witnesses describing the multiple levels beneath T2, beneath foreign technology, and then the smell of formaldehyde. We have numerous witnesses who describe going past storage areas and the strong smell of embalming fluid. Well, they weren't embalming human beings' bodies at the base at that time. No, they worked with local funeral parlors, and that's, if something was a mishap, somebody died on the base, that's where it would go. And so why that smell, that type of thing? And all painted the impression, the image that foreign technology became the repository. It's where everything was arriving. It's where everything was being tested, where everything was being stored. When General Nathan Twining, who was head of Air Materiel Command, which was headquartered at Wright-Patterson in 1947, and he put out that letter, that famous letter, where he stated point blank, flat out, regarding flying saucers, flying discs, that the phenomenon was real and not visionary or fictitious. That witnesses were seeing dome-shaped, disc-shaped craft of 30 to 60 feet in diameter, and he describes the flight curve. Well, Twining only signed that letter. He didn't prepare it. If you go to the original officers and scientists who drafted that statement, that Twining, in signing it, he agreed with 100%. They were all officers and engineers from T2. Their names are on the original document. And I always point this out to my colleagues. Why would Twining be relying on engineers, people who specialize in propulsion, in propellers, in jets, in rockets at T3, I mean T2, if you didn't have anything in hand? If you take Roswell out of the equation,
Yes,
when
very good
that
point.
letter comes out, you only have sightings. You have a couple blurry photographs, and that's it. So, in other words, why are you relying on people who would have been hands-on with physical evidence? And I'm surprised how many of my colleagues here, that just completely goes over their head. They
Yes.
don't put two and two together.
Yes.
And they go, no, Twining wrote that. No, he didn't write the letter. Go to the original at the National Archives in Washington. The handwritten signatures are all on the back page above Twining's signature. They're the ones who prepared and wrote that statement. Now, I think regarding foreign technology, T2, what's the most fascinating of all is 20 years after Roswell, with the shutdown, the disbanding of Project Blue Book, and we had mentioned earlier my scientific director, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the chief scientific consultant on Blue Book. He essentially is fired, end of the project. But that's not what really happened. In fact, after Hynek had passed away in 1986, he saved documents that we discovered later, which demonstrated that he stayed on, that the Air Force had another project that continued after Blue Book. And Hynek's job description was consultant on controversial aerial phenomena. Would you believe, James, I have colleagues here in the States that argue that doesn't pertain to UFOs? Controversial aerial phenomenon? What are we talking about?
Yes.
Balloons? Russian satellites? Controversial? No. Talking again, UFOs. And he worked under Colonel George Weinbrenner. And who was Weinbrenner the director of at that time at Wright-Patt? Foreign Technology Division. So who took over after Blue Book? Foreign Technology Division. They were keeping Hynek on a short leash with the thought that here he was free, and in the public's viewpoint, the mainstream media, he was able to freely talk about this, to discuss this. They were concerned that Hynek would become a magnet, that somebody, that whistleblowers, that people who may have in their possession something from Roswell in 1947 would seek him out. The Air Force just washed their hands of the entire situation. So again, they wanted to make sure that if Hynek came up with anything, that he would be loyal and report it directly to them. Again, matter of documented fact. I'm not speculating.
Yes.
The documents, we published them.
And the historical basis of it, how they use the Condon Committee, University of Colorado, memory serves, as a means for the Air Force to just wash their hands of it. Look, it's their baby now. They're going to explain it away. We're out of the business, was the real message.
Right. And they got away with it. And the Condon Committee was a whitewash. It was all contrived. It was all scripted. They investigated, you know, whatever the Air Force turned over. The National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena provided them with their best cases. Whether they even looked into them or not isn't even part of the question. But the point can be made that even the Condon Committee couldn't explain 25% of the cases that they looked into. You don't leave 25% unanswered for and then say, we've answered for everything. We explained everything away. No, you didn't. No, you didn't. And even the Air Force Project Blue Book, they investigated over 13,000 cases, of which over 700 remained unexplained. That's 700 that still defied conventional explanation. That's a pretty hefty number.
Yes.
So the media, and again, the media have been willing accomplices in this, you know, this cover-up from day one. Because the one profession, the one group of people that the Pentagon needed to enlist from day one was the media. That if the media were snipping at your ankles and second-guessing you and always following up with investigative reports, how long are you going to contain this? So you had to essentially strike a deal. And it came down to, William Colby. William Colby was a former director of the CIA. And he actually made the statement at one point that there isn't anyone in the United States mainstream media that we don't own. So
that's a profound statement coming from a director of the CIA.
Precisely. And then as we both know, James, right after the famous overflights in Washington, D.C., a week apart in July of 1952, who was called in to essentially take over the investigation, but the CIA.
Yes.
The Robertson
battle. The Robertson
and
battle.
And the sole conclusion of the Robertson panel was that it wasn't the reports that needed to be discredited, but the witnesses. We need to discourage people from even coming forward, even reporting such events. And lest we forget who even concocted the very term, conspiracy kook, conspiracy nut. The CIA. They created that term.
Yes.
That anybody who comes up or steps out of lines, reports something that they would just soon not deal with, you're immediately labeled a conspiracy nut. And we know it's hard to crawl out of that stigma.
And the thing about Roswell and Wright Patt is there's so much hard evidence. Now, you talked about some of the witnesses at the Roswell side of things. There are some witnesses that have General Arthur Trudeau, not Trudeau, but Exxon, you mentioned earlier.
Excellent.
What about some of the clerk typists that were at Wright Patt? I think one was June Crane. There was another gal named Gladys, I seem to think. Could you tell us about them and what they saw and what they dealt with?
Well, June Crane, who we interviewed first, and we used her in our first book under a pseudonym. And then it was a police detective, good friend, James Clarkson, who got the full story from her. And then she went public with her name. And then James came out with his book on June. And brave, brave woman, because in the latter part of her life that she stepped forward. And again, talk about a whistleblower. Talk about someone who handled the material. That there were officers, there were crewmen on flights who would mention things that came on to the base at Wright Patt, where she was a secretary clerk, and she filed, I mean, she filed classified reports. That was her job. So she had a security clearance in handling such material, handling such documents. And so it wasn't out of the norm that things would be said in her presence. Things would be shown to her. And one of the flights that came in with wreckage and a piece of the memory material came across her desk. And she was essentially asked, "What do you think this is from? Where do you think this came from? What are your impressions of this?" And she described to us exactly what I mentioned earlier on all the, based on all the eyewitness testimony, that no matter what she did to it, no matter how she tried to cut it or tear it or burn it, no effect whatsoever. And that every time she placed it down, it smoothed right out. Perfect memory. So she knew it was something not made here on planet Earth. She lived with that all those years. And then it was after, in May of 1997, just before the 50th anniversary, when the Pentagon had another press conference and they were addressing the growing number of eyewitnesses we had to the non-human bodies, the bodies recovered at Roswell. And as you mentioned a number of times, and they came up with the fourth explanation, and that being the anthropomorphic wooden crash dummies. And June Crane had enough at that point. That's when she called up James Clarkson and said, "We need to talk. I'm going to go fully on the record, and I'm going to tell you what I experienced. And I don't care what can they do to me now. You know, I'm an older lady. I don't have long to go, and I am going to, you know, tell the world what I experienced." It had nothing to do with crash dummies, and it certainly had nothing to do with a weather balloon device. So the crash dummy report, May of 1997, and they were referring specifically to Project Excelsior and Project High Dive, and that these were 6 foot tall wooden crash dummies, combination of wood and plastic. They were metal hinged at the joints, and they were used for a high, as far as high parachute experimentation with breathing apparatus. And so they would have worn jumpsuits, harnesses, parachutes, and even based on the very person, I interviewed his son who designed them, who assembled them, who would have to reassemble them after every drop. Because according to him, every time they were used, every time they were tested, they broke up. Legs, arms, the head, everything, you know, dismembered, you know, as far as all. We don't have a single witness describing any dismemberment. We don't have a single witness describing body 6 foot tall. We don't have a single witness describing bodies made of plastic or wood or metal hinged. And we certainly don't have any bodies describing wearing harnesses or parachutes. behind their backs. And the kiss of death for the Pentagon and all this is that Project Excelsior and High Dive didn't originate until 1952, 5 years after Roswell. 5 years after Roswell. So then the Pentagon, they come up with a new medical ailment called time compression. The idea that the older you get, not only do you start to confuse the years, but also the decades. I defy any of your viewers, any of your listeners, to find that in a single medical journal anywhere. There's no such thing. No such thing. So we put out a press release. We applauded the Pentagon for acknowledging that there was some semblance of bodies reported. They were acknowledging bodies. Now, they came up with an alternative explanation that didn't fit. The shoe didn't fit at all. But nonetheless, thank you. Thank you. And again, balloons don't have bodies, don't have pilots. And then the second press release we put out, and we also thank you because you're claiming that our witnesses were from 1952. Well, let's just say that for all of our military witnesses from 1947, none of them were there in 1952. They had all been reassigned or they had left the service and they went back home. So again, total disconnect. You cannot put witnesses who were there in 47 there to witness something in 52. Your time compression isn't a physical, it's a memory thing. So on both counts, you strike out, you lose. We had we challenged the New York Times that we had firsthand witnesses to the bodies. And they came back. If you can come up with a single firsthand witness to non-human bodies back in 47, not only will we recant the original balloon story, but also the present one. Also, the mogul balloon with the wooden crash dummies. We'll retract that. Well, we didn't come up with one. We came up with eight. I think we floored the editorial, the newsroom at the Times because they backed down. It's like, well, we told you one and you came up with eight, so we're sorry.
Can you give us the names of those eight witnesses that have seen the bodies?
Well, they would have been, as far as we had a deputy sheriff at that time. We had a fireman at that time by the name of Ed Reeves. We had Elazar Benavides, who was an MP on the base at that time. We had Melvin Brown, who we had talked about earlier off mic, as far as who was one of the MPs who saw the bodies. We had Frederick Benthal, who was a photographer, who was brought in from Washington. He was taken out to the crash site. He was taken to a tent. They pulled up the tarp, and he was ordered to photograph some of the bodies. If we had O.W. Pappy Henderson,
yes,
who was with the Green Hornets. He flew a C-54. And some of the bodies that were loaded onto a C-54 that went directly to Wright Field. We had Walter Hott, who was the public information officer. And before he would sign his sealed statement, which he also described seeing bodies out at the hangar under a tarp at building P3. It was a B-29 hangar, which became building 84. So if I had to think about it, I'm sure I could come up with more. But those were the ones that immediately come to mind.
Well, there's a sequence of events and a cast of characters, because if memory recalls, the book you co-wrote with Tom Carey, he talks about the was it the lieutenant governor of New Mexico, or
Yes.
having seen
At
the
the time.
bodies and almost going into a state of, not bodies, but actually a living ET and almost going into a nervous breakdown.
Yes. Yeah. And Senator Joseph Montoya, he was known as Senator Little Joe. But as you mentioned, James, at the time he was lieutenant governor. Now, the governor at that time was on vacation. So Lieutenant Governor Montoya was in Roswell, not only for the 4th of July weekend, but also for the dedication of a new plane on the base. So it was very conceivable that you had a state official, that they would have taken the chance that before you had officials arrive from Washington, that according to what Montoya told both Pete and Ruben Anaya, they were brothers, they had campaigned for Montoya when he ran as far as for the state office, and then they would campaign with him when he would run for senator for the state of New Mexico. And there was another witness by the name of Moses Prasad. We had interviewed both Pete and Reuben before they died, and they described how one of them received the phone call that afternoon, which we believe was Tuesday, July 8th. And it was the lieutenant governor. And he said, "I'm out at the base here. I need you to come pick me up right away. Get me out of here right away." "Well, where will you be?" "I'll be at the water tower. I'll be at the water tower by the big hangar." And that's what the hangar, P3, Building 84, where the bodies were stored, was also called at that time. Now, both the Anaya brothers worked as civilians on the base. So they had passes in their windshields on there, so they could have driven through the front gate, which they did. And Moses Prasad was in the back seat. And there's Montoya waiting at the water tank, at the water tower, which I should point out was still there until just a couple of months ago. They finally took it down and replaced it with a new water tank at the industrial park there, which was the former Roswell Army Airfield. So Montoya, he gets in the back seat and he's just beside himself. And he keeps cupping his face with both of his hands and he keeps, shaking his head. And he doesn't really say much of anything. He just keeps muttering to himself. "And should we take you back to the hotel?" Well, he would have been staying at the then Nixon Hotel in downtown Roswell. And he went, No, I need a drink. I need a drink. Take me home. Take me to one of your homes. I need a drink." And they would take him into the house, into the front room, and there would be a bottle of scotch. And he just took a couple gulps immediately. And then he started to say, "They weren't human. You won't believe it. They weren't human." And then he described how they escorted him into that hangar. They took him in through a side door. They took him where they had wreckage strewn, this strange metal strewn all over the floor. And there was a canvas tarp off to the side. And it looked like something was beneath. You could see the silhouette of what looked like short, figures. But then he said off to the side, it wasn't completely covered. And you could see a knee sticking out. And as he got closer, it sounded like it was actually moaning. And then the knee started to rock back and forth. And he realized, "Oh my God, this isn't a human being." So he would fall asleep on the couch. And when he woke, before he had an aide come to pick him up, he told all three of them, "Now, if you ever say anything, which I've just told you, I will say that you are damn liars. I will have the FBI come and make it very hard on you. So don't you ever repeat repeat anything that I just mentioned. Well, they wouldn't till after he passes away. And that's how we learned. Not only from the two brothers, their wives, who told us the exact same story that they also would hear. So there's the lieutenant governor. Why would they lie about something like that? And it wasn't like, well, I saw this strange material and it was really bizarre. No, he saw not only non-human bodies, but he saw one still alive. And we have other witnesses to that effect. A sheriff who also saw the survivor, a fireman who was a crew chief by the name of Dan Dwyer. And his assistant, whose name was Ed Reeves. And they drove out in their private car after they got word about the crash north of town. And they too saw the survivor who was stumbling and walking near the crash site. And then, like I mentioned, Elazar Benavides, where they were at the big hangar. And they were immediately sent. He said they were ordered rifles. They were commissioned rifles that they were to shoot, but lethal force was approved. Anyone getting near or within 200 feet of that hangar. And they were ordered to load up these gurneys, stretchers, into the back of an ambulance truck and escort them immediately over to the base hospital, just down from the hangar. And one of the men stepped on the covering, the sheet draped over the gurney. And according to Elazar Benavides, he said that as the sheet pulled free, there he was within inches of the face. The rumors were true. And then the eyes opened.
Ugh.
It took Tom Carey and me 2 years to get Benavides to finally talk to us. And it was his wife who pleaded with us because she couldn't get him to talk about this. She described to us that they slept in separate rooms for 40 years because of the reoccurring, the chronic nightmares, the screaming that Benavides would bolt up in the middle of the night over and over again because he couldn't get the face out of his mind. And when he breaks down and he finally tells us, he wept like a baby. I mean, we're sitting there with this man and he is sobbing as he's describing what I just mentioned to you. Crash dummies don't do that. Crash dummies don't have that effect. And grown men, unless they're the best actors in the world, to what end? He wasn't writing a book. He didn't even allow us to use his right name until after he passed away. So to what gain, what end? And we could fill up hours talking about these witnesses, James. I think you see that now.
Yeah, yes.
And again, weather balloons don't have pilots.
They don't have pilots, and they don't elicit that kind of reaction out of the witnesses,
no.
And certainly not the kind of reaction from the government and the military towards their own citizens. Which there was a human tragedy behind all this, Donald, which really irks me no end.
Absolutely. And the fact that these families were forced to live in that fear, with that intimidation for decades, all that time. Walter Hott, who I'd mentioned in putting out the press release and then signing that sealed statement where he acknowledged they'd seen the craft, the wreckage. He had handled the wreckage. They'd seen the bodies, including the survivor. Even his wife described to us that for 30 years, they were getting phone calls in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, when she would pick up, thinking it was a family member, you know, and something dire, something that just happened. So she wasn't going to ignore it. She'd pick it up. And there would be this voice saying, Mrs. Hart, if either you or your husband ever say a word about Roswell, you will die. You will be killed. Your family will be killed. Just imagine what type of individuals even do that and would do it for 30 years. And we're having the wife describe this to us. And I'm sorry that the best the skeptics can come up with, well, they're all liars. They're liars.
Yes.
They're liars. Well, but that onus is on you. That onus is on you, because in a law, in a courtroom, you would have to demonstrate that they were liars.
That's right.
You would have to prove they were liars. I don't have to prove they're telling the truth. You're making that accusation. I'm not. I'm just reporting what they've stated unanimously, what they're all stating. And yet you would have the gall to just say, well, let's just reduce this down to just a couple of people sitting around, you know, a few drinks late at night, and they concocted the whole story. No, not describing where they threatened to kill their children, and not their children also breaking down and crying over the fact that, my God, what my parents had to live through in a country that had just won World War II, with a military that walked on water at that time, for saving the world from Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, and then to have that all dashed against the rocks over a weather balloon?
Yes. No.
No. No.
Well, thanks for coming on the show, Donald. We'll definitely have you back on again. And thank you for all the great work that you've done over
thank
the years. To
you.
Me, you're one of the you're a living legend. I mean, you're much too modest to believe that. But you know, from my historical perspective, I hold you in the highest esteem. So thank you so much again for coming on to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
My pleasure. I look forward to the next time, James. Good luck in all that you do as well. And thank you for providing this opportunity and, you know, this show to spread the word, get the truth out, and let people decide for themselves. So I applaud you. Thank you, James.
Thank you. And to our dear listeners out there, wherever you may be, whatever you may be doing, have a very pleasant time.